Hello, I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
We welcome you today. We have 2 hours of fascinating conversation. We're going to start off in the Middle East. We're going to hear a conversation I had earlier this morning with Jahan Hafiz, who is Egyptian correspondent of the Real News Network. She'll join us to talk about what's going on there right today. We're joined by Adil Shamu and Suni Khalid here in the studio. Later in the program, John Rosenthal with a different view of Syria as we turn from Egypt to Syria. And in the next hour, we will look at what happened here in Baltimore County with the killing the other week, last week, of a young man in Randallstown by an off-duty police officer. And we will have a roundtable discussion on what is going on, especially around the issue of what people call institutional racism, what's going on inside of police departments and young black men in our community and in our country. So stay with us for all of that. Right now we're going to turn this over to the conversation we had earlier today with Jahan Hafiz, Egyptian correspondent for Real News Network, and come back to our conversation. Stay with us. This is Mark Steiner. We're about to talk with Jahan Hafiz, who is in Cairo. She's a reporter in Cairo for the bureau running for the Real News that you can see. We'll connect to them and all the work she's been doing. And Jahan, welcome back. Wonderful to have you with us once again.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark. It's good to be back with you.
So, Jahan, I was looking at your latest reports of the election and the rulings of the military junta. I mean, from your perspective, you've been there from the beginning, covering from Tahrir Square on out. And it just seems as if this is almost a coup in some ways against the push for democracy.
Yes, well, we've been reporting, as you mentioned, since the beginning of the revolution, and it was actually the military was not voted in by the people. The military simply took over from the former president. And the man who has been serving the country and who has been controlling everything for the most part, Field Marshal Hussein Tantawi, he's actually the former defense minister of Mubarak. And so since then, a number of the rulings, a number of actions, a number of political decisions, people say conspiracies and game playing that's been happening, has been taking place on behalf of the military council. And everyone, a lot of Egyptians now who are either boycotting the elections or nullifying their votes or really simply voting out of obligation and nothing else to do, they went to the, some of them did not participate in the elections, but some of them did go to the elections, even knowing that the incoming president was not going to have as much power as expected. The military council was simply supposed to be a transitional stage for the Egyptian people following the revolution. However, since that transitional period took place, 6 months they failed to transfer power, 9 months failed to transfer, and a year and a half later still failing to transfer power. And in fact, a number of judicial actions that have taken place have authorized the military council with even more power and even more authority to govern over the Egyptian people, stripping away powers of the newly elected president and dissolving one-third of the parliament. Now, this, of course, is not going well with a lot of people who participated in these elections and who participated in the military council's so-called transitional rule. They played by the military council's book throughout this transitional period, and now they see the military council using the judiciary to not only shoot down their political gains, but also to put themselves on a higher mantle than they had been. So it's been a political mess here. People are confused. People are in despair. People are feeling apathetic. And through this, they're still feeling hopeful that they can continue the revolution, even as it seems the military is honing in more on their demand for democracy.
Well, Jahan, I'm curious what your analysis is about what is really going on, because things tumbled very quickly, at least from the perspective of us watching it and reading it in the Western press. I mean, here we have just a few days ago, the military, the Supreme Court, disbanding the parliament, bringing back emergency powers, allowing that to happen. And then the Egyptian military announcing it was going to severely restrict the what authority the new president had, that they would retain the lead as the head of the armed forces and all the legislative powers. Why do you think this tumbled out so quickly over the last few days? What transpired to make that happen?
Yes, well, I mean, what's mainly been happening is the military council has been planning for this to take place. there's been lots of tensions have been very high in the weeks coming up to the elections. There was this controversial court case that came up, and this was a ruling that everyone had been waiting on because they knew that it would determine the future of if there was going to be an election or not. And so a lot of people are seeing this playing in perfectly to the military council's game, as they call it. For example, they dissolved the parliament that was almost useless during this transitional period. The so-called democratically elected parliament that was elected in November and December of last year and January of this year has been unable to pass the minuscule and the most meaningless of laws. And the barricade they keep facing is the military council. So, of course, on the streets, of course, in the villages and the governance, people are growing very pessimistic with the Muslim Brotherhood. They're blaming the Islamists for the failures, political failures in the country, when it's really the military council all the time that has had this power. So as the vote came down last week, just 2 days before the elections, it shook the entire political atmosphere here in Egypt. Revolutionaries were in disarray over the announcement. The predominantly Islamist parliament was in disarray because they had a candidate that just ran this election and, according to unofficial results, won the election. And so they're seeing that there, and at least in the minds of some analysts and revolutionaries here, that the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamdi Zbahi, who was a nationalist, played in to the military council saying, yes, there will be a president, we will take away your Islamist parliament, and you will eventually have no powers whatsoever. So it's now dawned on people that this was sort of the chessboard, and they played the pawns the proper way, and they were able to roll the dice, and the revolutionaries had been out of the loop in all of this. They've been protesting and battling state security forces, and violence erupts, but it's in the end the blood of martyrs, as Egyptians often say, is still wet in the streets, and nothing has been done to justify what took place and to eradicate the country of poverty and corruption. And so a lot of people are in despair here because they're seeing that the military council has the authority to do this, that there's nothing that can stop them, no boycott, international movements, no United Nations. This is something they will do, obviously, in front of people's eyes. The game's exposed, and it's happening, and there's nothing that's stopping it at the moment.
So I a couple of things I was wondering. I mean, when you talk about the revolutionaries, clearly you're talking about the people who took to Tahrir Square early and made this fight. But in some ways, when you look at what happened, and you know this better than I or most of us listening right now, were these young revolutionaries kind of naive in the sense that they're thinking that just getting rid of Mubarak was going to end this kind of nationalistic military structure that has really run Egypt on some level since Nasser? I mean, that they were actually going to be able to change things by just having Mubarak removed? Was there a sense of political naivete there, or are we missing part of the story?
Yes. Well, the question of being naive and being unaware of the military's stronghold in this country, especially with the economy and the government for the past 60 years, I think it was the euphoria and the ability to remove Mubarak, who was a very ruthless dictator for 30 years. They found in that it took away their fear. So they, for months, throughout the monthly violence that would happen here in Egypt by the military, they were able to fight that off and carry on with their revolution in hopes that something would happen that would remove the military council. But now people are seeing that there must be a new strategy that comes out because the military council is acting regardless of what happens on the streets. And they're also acting in a very deceitful way, and that they're manipulating the political forces on the ground into either turning against each other or to organizing massive events that other organizations or other parties or other organizations don't attend. And so it has created a rift within the revolutionary forces. It has called a lot of questioning into how to mobilize, how now to fight this kind of dictatorship. But to be honest, when you walk the streets of the city, you see remnants and the identity and the existence of this revolution. It's a revolution that happened because of young people, and 50% of this population is under the age of 25. If things don't happen to work out as Egyptians see that this is true, that the military junta is controlling everything, and people are going to be detained and arbitrary detentions and convictions are going to happen under military tribunals, then I do believe that's going to mobilize, it's going to enrage people to hit the streets. And I think it will be spontaneous. It won't be like these planned events that we've seen January 25th, January 28th. It will be something more spontaneous where people can't take it anymore. They hit the streets. And things here in Egypt are very fickle. It really does take one domino to push the entire population over the edge. And this is a very tired population under the military council. Inflation rates have risen. $2 billion worth of the country's wealth has been squandered by the military council in trying to fix the economy. And things are really in a mess. There's no security. There's no stabilization in this country, and people are yearning for something. And so I believe they will be patient. I believe there will be apathy. I believe they'll be waiting to see what happens. But I think something, maybe the murder of someone, the torture, death of someone typically, is going to ignite something that's going to send people back onto the streets and possibly remove military junta, which has been an unremovable thorn in this country for six decades.
So finally, Johanna, as you look at Egypt and the Egyptian people and the political situation in Egypt, we saw the election results in the first round. I mean, how – two things. I mean, A, how divided is the Egyptian society when it comes to what comes next? And you could see it in the vote where in terms of the presidential vote. A lot of people – I mean, it's a really kind of – between the Islamists, the folks who are like almost kind of pine for Mubarak – the revolutionaries who want real change, the Democrats and liberals as well. I mean, it seems to be a very divided nation.
Yes, it's turning into that. I think they're calling it the counter-revolution. They said it started back in June of last year. And it happened when the government, through the state media machine, starts spewing all this propaganda about socialists. They're open to communism, and they're having marital, social norms that aren't typical, like sex without being married and such. And then they would demonize the April 6th and said that they will become the Americans. And so the state media has created a lot of these divisions. And because of the lack of security and the lack of stability and lack of jobs in the country and the rising rate of poverty, a lot of these myths are believed. And of course, I believe 40% of the population is illiterate. And in some cases, some statistics here in Egypt, so 60% of the population can't read and write. And with this, you have a very dangerous element of the government wing, which happens to be the media. The radio and the state media is very strong in all governance and all villages and all cities. And it's been very, very successful in spewing venomous propaganda against revolutionaries, against socialists, against workers, against Democrats, against liberals, Islamists. And because of this, we're seeing political divisions within people when Egyptians are actually a homogeneous society. The culture is the same. The Arabic's the same. There are different regions that have different ways, but for the most part, Egyptians are hand in hand. So they're creating this political scheme where even Ahmed Shafiq supporters started clashing with Mohamed Morsi supporters. So there were Islamist versus pro-military supporters happening at some of the polling stations yesterday. And this is as a result of a lot of propaganda that's being spewed on the state media. They did it. They tried doing it with foreigners. They put out this commercial where they were warning Egyptians about talking to a foreigner, how they're coming to destroy the country. They're spying on you. They're writing about all your problems. And of course, this is lots of nonsense because anyone that wants to know about the poverty and the problems in this country can look up Wikipedia or any other information. And in fact, it's the Egyptian government that receives lots of money from the American government. So this is this kind of information that goes out on a mass stream to people has been effective in creating these divisions. And I think, unfortunately, the lack of connection and networking between the different groups and the different types of political forces here is also what's contributing to that division.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. We're talking with Jahan Hafez, who is the correspondent for Real News in Cairo. And Jahan, thank you so much. Thanks for all the work you do, and please stay safe.
Thank you very much, Mark. Lots of luck to the team. Thank you. Take care.
Take care. That was the interview I had earlier today with Jahan Hafez from the Real News Network. A young woman, as many women reporters are, I'm finding, in Cairo right now, are bold and brave, are standing up in the midst of things to get these reports back. And you can link to reports on our website. They're pretty amazing. We're here in the studio now, Anthony McCarthy and I are, with Adil Shamu, professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine and Institute for Policy Studies Associate Fellow and Foreign Policy and Focus Senior Analyst, who recently got back from Egypt.
Adil, yes.
Good to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
My dear friend, SUNY College in the studio, former managing news editor at WYPR, former NPR foreign correspondent and war correspondent, who covered Egypt and set up their short-lived but good Cairo bureau when he was there living in Cairo. And SUNY, good to have you in the studio here.
Thanks.
410-319-8888 is the number. One of the things that I think we have to grapple with is what may happen over the next few weeks. There was an article that I just finished reading from The Guardian as I was listening to Jahan as she was on the air, which is a British newspaper, saying that the Muslim Brotherhood are now massing in the streets and calling for massive demonstrations.
Yes.
If they don't give the president, not if they don't pull back, but if they don't give the president the power he deserves and reopen the parliament. So, and you have the young, more secular revolutionaries, as they call them, saying the same. So I wonder what you think, how this will play out. I mean, this is, we're talking about, as you know very well, SUNY, an entrenched, powerful military, deeply involved in the business life of Egypt, has been in power for 60 years, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 60 years. Nasser's revolution, July 1952. And Nasser overthrew and the Free Officers Movement overthrew King Farouk, overthrew the monarchy. And their battle cry was, we're here to wipe out the corruption and we're here to restore the dignity of the Egyptian people. And 60 years later, we have revolutionary forces which are trying to wipe out the corruption and restore the dignity of the Egyptian people. So I guess not much has changed in 60 years.
But this, just in terms of your ears to the ground in Cairo, you have a lot of contacts, a lot of friends. You're in touch with them constantly, sending me emails constantly about Egypt. So I'm curious what you think, both of you, what you think we're about to face in Egypt, because I think it has repercussions worldwide.
This is sad. I really hate to say this because I've been telling people that Egypt is not Syria. This was when I was in Cairo last 10 years ago. People were telling me Egypt is not Syria, that people could not see, for example, 10 years ago, Gamal Mubarak was being groomed by his father to succeed him. So you had the idea of a hereditary republic, which is what happened in Syria. And Egyptians are telling me this is not going to happen. We cannot allow this to happen. We're not Syria. Now, we can see the events in Syria where you had a pro-democracy movement, which was demonstrating, and they've been met with just tremendous brutality. I always tell people, the Egyptians are not a violent people, but I fear that what's going to happen within the next few weeks and months is a show of force. And you will see violence on the scale that has never been seen in the streets of Egypt. People should know that, and we were talking with the doctor here about the financial stake that the Egyptian military has. There are estimates that the Egyptian military has anywhere from $15 to $60 billion invested. All of the senior generals, the construction companies, the hotels, the resorts, real estate, and you're talking about money. And all of the presidential candidates, those who were in the first round, they really talked around the military because they were afraid of the military. The people have not seen the military. We have not seen the sort of wanton, very, very public acts. We have not seen Libya. We have not seen Syria. I'm afraid that this is what's going to happen because the military has a very, very vested interest. They are acting, and they will act to protect their financial interests, which are considerable.
Adil Shamu.
Well, you remember when I was in your show, I think over a year ago, when I said this was a coup light. And basically now it's a coup d'etat. The military has an extensive infrastructure throughout those 60 years of their rule. And that infrastructure is interwoven to the upper class of Egypt, the businessmen, and into the security forces. So dislodging them is not going to be very easy. The only hope I think the revolutionaries had was that they give it up. Truly, there are some military leader. You know, this is the problem with benign dictators. They may relinquish power to the people. But these guys I never thought they will, because the way they just came to power, they had an ailing, old, hated, corrupt regime, and this was a good way to get rid of them and preserve their, you know, their benefits all to them and other military forces. My greatest fear, really, is that we will have the Algerian experience all over again 15 years ago when the Muslim Brotherhood won the election, as you know, in Algeria.
20 years ago.
20 years ago. And the military took over in a coup and killed eventually over 100,000 people in the name of quote-unquote freedom and democracy, and unfortunately the West recognized their government immediately. That is the scariest thing, because you have 85 million Egyptians, and with tens of millions of really average Egyptians will be starving because it cannot afford that kind of chaos in Egypt.
It's a huge wager. Foreign policy. We're talking about what will the Obama administration do. Well, it was only 3 years ago that President Obama went to Cairo, went to the Opera House in Cairo, and gave this great speech talking about democracy and all these other things. Mubarak, of course, did not attend, which he stayed back in the presidential palace, the Al-Itaidia, and he did not attend it. But people are saying that was the real spark for, some people call it the Arab Spring. I prefer to call it the Arab Awakening. But for the administration now to back away, to essentially say, well, we said all these nice things, but we didn't really mean them. The Egyptian people and the Arab people are getting ready to see, are you going to put your money where your mouth is? It's a very cynical bargain. It's a very, very cynical wager, because the generals are saying that Egypt, they still see Egypt as the heart of the Arab world. It's the largest, it's the most populous country in the Arab world. Trends start in Egypt and go other places. So they have wagered. They're saying Egypt is the indispensable nation. We are indispensable to keeping Egypt stable. So what are you going to bet on? And I think this is very, very, very dangerous.
The day after, this is something really disturbing. The day after the parliament was invalidated by the Constitutional Court, and, of course, with the blessing of the military, our Secretary of Defense call up Tantawi, the head of the Supreme Council of Armed Forces, and tells him, we will be glad to deal with whoever the next president is, but, by the way, make sure that you have a nice transition to the new president, you know, to freedom and democracy. That was just thrown in there as a bone. To me, it's going to test really Obama's administration's policy in Middle East. Are we going to continue to be hated by Middle Eastern people, or are we going to at least have a new chapter? My hope was that Obama's presidency will bring a new chapter of freedom and democracy, at least in a sense, to the Middle East.
But this is not low-hanging fruit. This is not Libya. This is not low-hanging fruit. This is not Tunisia, which just sort of collapsed. And people, and I've been reading a lot of the British newspapers, they've been talking about the inconsistencies in the policy of supporting Libya, for example, the uprising in Libya, supporting the uprising in Tunis, not doing anything about Syria. Nobody wants to get into that, but a lot of people forget what's happening in Bahrain.
I was going to say, the doctors in Bahrain were just...
Yes.
Who
the home of the Fifth Fleet.
Right. And so those nine doctors are going to jail.
Yes.
Yes. I have emails from one of them.
You know,
continuously,
one of
them.
Well, I'm just curious, and I know we're running out of time quick.
No, we're good.
It's fast. Oh, good. I thought we had to go to break and then bring someone. I'm very curious, as I was reading before I came over to the station, I read statement after statement after statement from the military government spokesperson, who was almost jovial. He said, look, we're excited. We're excited for the transition, and we are looking forward to turning over power to the new president. Now, the fascinating thing is you wouldn't have to click very far to get some inside analysis about what really is happening. Of course, just these two brilliant voices that you just shared with us about your knowledge. How much can we trust the state media in Egypt?
You can't.
Okay.
And Egyptians don't trust them. This was the thing that surprised me. It had been 5 years since I had been in Egypt. The advent of Al Jazeera. Mm. And I had left in 97, went back in 2001, a month after 9/11. And the thing that really surprised me, Egyptians were saying, come over to my house, come over to my house so I can watch Al Jazeera. And it was funny to see how the Egyptian media did not have Al Jazeera's content, but they were sort of aping Al Jazeera. They got all these nice graphics and nice studios and things like that. People didn't care. People were only watching Al Jazeera or Al Arabiya. They had completely, the Egyptian media had been discredited, and I think you remember 1967, the 67 war. The first 3 days, there were celebrations in the streets in Cairo because the state-run media had said that the Egyptian army is smashing the Israelis. They're getting ready to march on Tel Aviv.
With maps.
This is all done on the voice of the Arabs. And after 3 days, when it became apparent that the Egyptian military was being actually the Egyptian army was destroyed. I think they lost 90% of all of their material, war material was being. And since then, the Egyptian people have been very, very sanguine. And information is power. I was talking to a friend of mine who was in Jordan during the invasion of Iraq, the first invasion, not the invasion of Kuwait, excuse me, in 1990. He was in Jordan next door to Iraq. He did not know that Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait, had no idea. Wow. But now you can't do that anymore because, I mean, it's not just Radio Monte Carlo. It's not just Voice of America because a lot of people don't trust trust Voice of America at all or Al Huda. They don't trust them at all. But Al Jazeera and the Internet. The other thing I was going to bring up, the murder by Egyptian police of Khalid Said.
Yes,
in Alexandria. They tried to keep that down.
It's his brother's name. Who was Khalid Said?
He was murdered. He was arrested outside of a restaurant.
But he was who?
He was just a regular Egyptian. They accused him of being a drug dealer, and then they said, well, he swallowed a packet of marijuana and died as a result of that. And then you saw the pictures that they showed. He had been beaten mercilessly. This was all over the Internet. The death was all over the Internet. Or, for example,
by two secret police agents.
And then I was telling Mark this time last about 2 years ago when I was getting reports from people in Egypt that there was a sort of a wilding in Talat Harb Square where groups of men went and were molesting women. And the Egyptian media said, no, this didn't happen. Within 30 seconds of them saying it didn't happen, people had cell phones. They were showing pictures and talking to people. So the big lie doesn't work anymore.
The big lie may not work, but the Egyptian military at this point seems to be firmly entrenched and in control.
Yes.
I mean, they've made it clear that they are legislating everything. The armed forces will answer to the commander in chief. Mm-hmm. They will make the legislative decisions.
These are the senior generals. The Egyptian army is a conscript army.
But I've heard that, Suni, but I'd like to very quickly comment on this. I've heard this before, but I've not seen any rumblings or any reports of any young Egyptian soldiers turning against the army.
I am not as optimistic as someone who used to be a youngster, revolutionary. We have a lot of zeal and hope and wishful thinking. And so I have about... I'm 50-50 whether the army will collapse if they slaughter the Egyptian people. I am hoping that that's what happened, what he says. But I am not sure because the Algerian experience, they won. I mean, it's incredible.
But in 1977, in 1977, when you had the bread riots after Sadat decided to eliminate the subsidies for Aish bread, which is what all Egyptians live on, he sent the troops into the streets to tamp down the rioting. They did not. After 3 days, they could not. They could not tamp it down. He had to rescind his position. Only after he rescinded the position did you get any kind of peace. That was seen as an impetus, one of the reasons why Sadat went to Jerusalem, because he realized he was in an untenable situation, and he had to come up with a peace dividend that, of course, never really came to be.
Folks, I want you to join Anthony McCarthy and me here at 410-319-8888 as we talk with Adil Shamoon, SUNY College, soon to be joined by John Rosenthal, and continue our conversation about Egypt, look to Syria, talk about American policy in the Middle East and where it should go, how it should affect us, and how we should be reacting to it as a nation and government. 410-319-8888. On our way there, let me remind you before we jump out of here that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. For more information, www.mecu.com or go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. We'll be right back. That was Wortha, the Algerian singer.
Algerian Rose.
Algerian Rose.
Who died in Cairo 2 weeks ago.
And I remember that I started bringing all of her music down and downloading it, but SUNY sent me an email that she passed away. An amazing singer, one of the queen of Egyptian music, of Arabic music. SUNY College in the studio. He's former managing news editor, WYPR, former NPR foreign and war correspondent, who spent a lot of time in Egypt setting up their Egyptian bureau. Dr. Adil Shamoon with us here. He's professor at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, Institute for Policy Studies Associate Fellow and Foreign Policy and Focus Senior Analyst. We're also joined by John Rosenthal, Anthony McCarthy and I are. I'm sorry, you didn't see Anthony McCarthy. I'm sorry, I just jumped right in with that.
That's all right, brother.
Writes on European politics and transatlantic security issues. He's been covering Syria for the National Review and other publications. And John, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Thanks for having me.
410-319-8888 is the number here. So the question is, how does, I mean, this is the debate of the moment, at least in the United States of America. How does the American government respond to all of this? How should it respond to all of this? Whether it's to take the broader issues, whether it's the civil war brewing in Syria, the democracy being crushed but never existed in Egypt, what's happening in Bahrain, what's happening in, I mean, what is the American response? It's not a simple answer, I think, for people to give. I'm just curious what you think. Oh, we'll start, since John just started out with this, let's start with John, and we'll go to Adil and over to SUNY. John.
Okay. Well, again, as you mentioned, I've been covering Syria, and I should mention that my real beat is European politics, so I've been using European sources to try to get at some aspects of the Syrian conflict that maybe haven't been reported as much in the American media. So it seems to me that the chief problem and the chief question for American policy vis-a-vis Syria is whether one maintains a position of neutrality or whether one pushes for intervention, basically adopting a position of support for the rebellion. And the position so far of the Obama administration has been the latter. We have been supporting the rebellion. We've been talking about sending recently non-lethal aid, that is communication equipment, to the rebellion. And certainly, via the so-called Friends of Syria group, We've been providing a lot of diplomatic support for the rebellion, as have other actors, France, notably Great Britain in terms of European actors, and of course Qatar and Saudi Arabia in terms of regional actors in the Middle East. Whereas one could argue that we would be better served by maintaining a position of neutrality. That is to say, there is a UN mission which is on the ground, as you know, maybe you've already discussed it on the show today. That mission recently suspended its activities because of the level of violence in Syria right now. And whereas from the media, from most of the American media, most of the European media as well, we've been hearing that essentially the Syrian government is responsible for the great mass of the violence. If you listen to the reports of the UN mission, and notably its head, General Robert Mood, they have a much, much more nuanced version of what's been going on. Even as concerns the Al-Hula massacre, the Al-Hula massacre was obviously an extremely atrocious event. Over 90 people massacred, many of them women and children. But the problem is that the U.S. media, again, the European media, did largely the same thing, immediately attributed responsibility to the Syrian government, to either Syrian government troops, the army, or to so-called militias, the Shabiha militias, I believe one says. Whereas, again, the U.N. mission sent a team to Al-Hula. Their investigation almost did not get reported at all, neither in the European press nor in the American press. Yet if one looks at the results of their investigation, what they say is, we were on the ground. We don't know who was responsible for the massacre. And in fact, Robert Mood gave a press conference just 3 days ago. I was astonished today. I was looking online. It's available. You can go to the UN Observer mission. Has its own YouTube account, so you can find the press conference very easily. And Robert Mood said, well, we talked to people. We obviously investigated the facts on the ground, that is the material damage, the wounds, the hideous wounds which were suffered by many of these children and women and others. But we also talked to people. We talked to locals. And what he said was not that the locals told us that the Syrian government was responsible or that Alawite militias were responsible. What he says is that some locals told us one story and some locals told us completely another story. And it's that other story that I'm afraid is really not getting a hearing in the American media. And so long as it doesn't get a hearing in the American media, there's always the danger that an American policy is going to be based on a very partial vision of what's happening on the ground.
Adil Shamu.
Well, I think it's a chance now for the United States. I hoped that chance came up when President Obama took over for a broad policy, whether they should be neutral or interventionist, and what they see Middle East in the next decade or two. And it hasn't happened. I have written against intervention in Syria. The same thing I did with Libya. Only really under unique circumstances that the U.S. should intervene. But more importantly, we have to be transparent. How should we intervene? What are the conditions? And what are the conditions for us staying there and for how long? And to my surprise, none, neither the U.N., nor the U.S., nor the Western European countries who, through the NATO, you know, they intervene in several places. They don't declare that we are going there to protect the citizens, the minorities, and that if we accomplish this within 1 year, we are leaving, or bring neutral troops from India, Canada. We don't do that. We sent NATO. NATO has never been historically a neutral agent for intervention. So that to me is so important for us to say when we will intervene, when not, and when would we leave, and why would we leave. And we are not going to write their constitution like we did in Iraq. We sent our own professors to write their own constitution and determine their future and give them 600 laws by one individual, Paul Bremer. That's really what's happening, even in Libya to a certain degree. The Western powers dictate to the local countries how to behave in the future.
Sunni, then we'll open the phones.
This is not low-hanging fruit. Syria is a mess for anyone who wants to go in there. I wanted to bring up one point about acting unilaterally, acting transparently. You can't act unilaterally in Syria. It's impossible. The Turks have to be brought in. The other role that isn't really talked about a lot in the American media is the role of the Gulf countries. For example, the Saudis and the Qataris are supporting the rebels there. I'm not so sure that we're on the same side in Egypt, for example, because the Arab Spring blows into the Gulf as well. And I think you'll probably find the Saudis, because Egypt has always been on the teetering on the brink of bankruptcy, that the Saudis will probably be more supportive of the military regime, the junta, which is more like them, in Egypt. So we may be on the same side in Syria, but we'll be on different sides when it comes to Egypt or some of the other places. For example, Bahrain. The Saudis have essentially annexed. We used to call it Saudi Vegas when we were in Egypt, because the Saudis used to go there and do whatever dirt they wanted to do, go across the causeway and come back. They've essentially invaded there, seeing that is a Shia rebellion. The Shia, of course, being the majority in Bahrain, and the Americans have said nothing. I don't know if a coherent policy is possible. And because they're so all these cases are so different.
Well, also, as you know, Saudi Arabia has probably spent $1 billion on Syrian opposition to foment the rebellious among the Sunnis against the Alawite. So the Gulf states have played really a dirty role.
Now, I'm going to open the phones here. So, Corio and Mike, we're going to get you with both your calls. But this is the complexity that I think we don't always want to deal with. The complexity of, say, Syria now. I have no fondness for Assad, for the Assads at all.
Who does?
Who does?
Yeah, who does?
Assad's mama.
But you know, you can see the complexity of it when you know that there are a huge portions of the Christian community support Assad out of their own self-interest of being fearful
protected.
What would happen if the different Sunni elements took over. There's, as John Rosenthal wrote, there's some people who say that the massacres took place where people were killed were Alawites and Shias who were killed by Sunni forces that they're trying to lay on to the Egyptian government. On the other side, I mean, this is a very complex situation, as is the whole of the Middle East. It's almost as if, how can I put this? And I get your thoughts. If we harken back to the Ottoman Empire, when it ran all of the Middle East.
I'm still bitter about that.
You're harking back to the Ottoman Empire. And then you look at what happened after World War I and dividing up the Arab lands and the colonial powers. And then all the kind of exportation of oil and the relationships between power elites in the Arab countries in the post-colonial era. This is as if it's in some ways it's the Arab equivalent of what's going on in Europe and other places around the world, where it's kind of the contradictions are coming to the fore. Nobody can figure out how to play them out, which is an argument for why maybe America should not intervene, because it's just a complex, moving situation. You don't know which way things are going to turn.
But Mark, we really intervene. Even now, we are not intervening. We are intervening. We have covert operations. We have money laundering to the side we think it's the right side. We have a diplomacy. We are a very powerful country. We don't have to send only boots on the ground to interfere in Middle East, because we have a lot of agents there doing our bidding that is in power, like the military personnel in Egypt, you know, Tantawi and his group.
With American weapons.
Exactly. And guess what? The top probably 10,000 military officers in Egypt, including Tantawi, were trained
in
our country.
Fort Leavenworth.
Exactly. So we have a huge, huge influence. All their military supplies, or most of it, are American made. We could have funnel it either slow or large, and that will influence their capabilities. So we do interfere.
So, John, very quickly, and then I'll go over to the phones, unless Sunnis wants to jump in.
Okay. Yeah, you know, I think one also has to consider what exactly is the objective of intervening. I think your last commentator is absolutely right. We are intervening, and France is intervening, and Qatar is intervening,
that's
and
right.
Saudi Arabia is intervening, and Turkey is intervening. There's plenty of intervention. What there's not yet is the sort of direct military intervention that we had in Libya. But before we even get to the point of asking whether such a military intervention is justified, I think one has to ask, what is the objective of intervention? Now, I suppose there's some, I guess one could say, realist geopolitical analysts who might say, yeah, well, we should intervene because it's going to weaken Iran. So there's a geopolitical objective. And it's a kind of regional battle going on for hegemony between the Sunni Gulf monarchies and Shia Iran, and we should take sides. I think it's extremely questionable if we should take sides in that kind of battle, but that would be one way of describing an objective in intervention.
John?
But actually, if you consider the way the reporting or the media coverage of the Syrian conflict has been playing itself out, no one has ever said, really, that's the objective. The objective is to stop the killing.
That's right.
Well, if the objective is to stop the killing, I would say we and the French and the British and the Qataris and the Saudis have to stop intervening. Because actually, right now, the rebellion has all the interest to continue receiving support from Western countries, from local regional powers, and shoving all the blame for the violence onto the side of the Syrian government. As long as that continues happening, we're going to see an escalation of the violence. The rebellion is not going to have any motivation to seek peace. And again, I'd very much recommend to your listeners to check out Robert Mood's press conference. One of the points he makes is that they're there, that is to say the UN mission, is there to monitor a truce between two sides. If those two sides are not agreed that they want peace, then there won't be peace. The UN mission cannot. There's nothing more to observe.
One thing in all of my years reporting, especially in that part of the region, one thing that for Americans, we like Westerns, and they're the good guys and the white hats and the bad guys
exactly.
with the black hats. But
exactly.
there are a lot of people with gray hats running around here.
Exactly.
And that's really the sad part. The point I wanted to make was this whole thing about intervention. I was on a BBC program 2 weeks ago, and I said that if you want to stop the killing in Syria, you're going to have a military intervention. And then I was automatically castigated for calling for a NATO intervention, which I have not called for. but you know, if you want to stop it, there's a way to do it, but it has a tremendous cost. The American military is overstretched completely. Syria is not low-hanging fruit. And the other thing, when you talk to people in the region, they're concerned about intervention, not only in Iraq, which was a war which was fought under very, very dubious justification. A lot of people are looking toward the fall because the Israelis are talking about going after nuclear sites in Iran. So if there is an intervention in Syria, you've already set the precedent. And this is something that that people in the region are very, very worried about, that if you have one intervention, then it justifies another intervention, which justifies another intervention.
Well, look,
let me go to the phone. So,
yeah, sure.
410-310-8888. Corio, you're on the air. Corio, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. Imperialism, agents of imperialism, has never been the answer. You guys are jokers.
Thanks a lot. But what do you have a point besides name calling?
Excuse me?
You have a point besides name calling?
Excuse me?
Do you have a point other than name calling?
I'm not calling any name. I said agents of imperialism. And has never been the answer. The answer must be self-determination.
All right, so let me ask this question. I hear you, and I think that people have said similar things in this panel, but so what would be... So what does that mean? I understand the rhetoric, but what does that mean in terms of...
It's not rhetoric, sure. I'm saying self-determination.
Right. And so,
okay.
Well, yeah, I don't think that we disagree with that, but what does that mean?
You disagree with that?
No.
I said, no, we do not.
Well, you're not talking about it.
Well, I mean, so the Syrian government has a right to kill as many tens of thousands of people as they want to. The Egyptian military has the right to kill tens of thousands of people.
Are you talking about the FSA?
Excuse me?
Have you mentioned the FSA?
The Free Syrian Army.
The Free Syrian Army.
The so-called Free Syrian.
Free Syrian. I'm talking about a government. Self-determination, you're talking about governments, you're talking about groups. Who has the right to you have the right to essentially flout international convention.
Look,
so I'm saying if something is not done, If something is not done, okay, self-determination, we have the right to kill whoever we want to, as many people as we want to, for whatever reason. And the international community has no responsibility at all, has no role to play.
But the rule of law,
human rights, they could be trampled on, all in the name of self-determination. That's fine, because the Syrian government will be stacking up bodies like cordwood from now until the cows come home.
But Sunni, we need to know if we intervene, is it going to be worse?
I agree.
Instead of 5 million dead, are we going to get 10 million dead?
I agree.
This is exactly what happened in Iraq. Under the name of humanitarian, quote-unquote, intervention for freedom and democracy, which we knew, our interventionist knew that that wasn't the case.
But let's wrestle with what Corio is saying here, with the notion of self-determination. How is that defined, and what do we mean by that in this particular, these struggles we're seeing in the Arab world?
These are outmoded concepts from these. I think these are concepts that are outmoded, need to be adapted to a new world, to a new world order, because we're talking about ethnic groups or religious groups within countries. Do they have the right of self-determination? Does that trump the right of a state or a corrupt state or an unrepresentative state? It's a mess. No one's worked out these rules in the new world order.
I am not so sanguine about intervention so easily, really. And there are any guys. That's why there has to be unique and compelling circumstances. When he puts tens of thousands of people against the wall and starts slaughtering them, yes. But why do we have to send a biased military force to occupy those nations? Why can't we send neutral forces?
And that's what the UN mission is supposed to. The UN mission right now is not a force. It's not armed.
No, I'm with you. I'm with you.
Excuse me?
No, I am with you.
You can finish what you're saying, Robert. I mean, John.
Just that, absolutely. I think there, if you have already two sides which are willing to establish a truce or a ceasefire, then you can have an interventionary force or an intermediary force of the UN, for instance, not NATO, but of the UN, to try to maintain that peace, as one says.
But this is a zero-sum game.
But we don't have that. And so long as the U.S. and its European allies and the Gulf states make clear that they're taking sides in the conflict, then the other side in the conflict, namely the FSA, really just it doesn't have any kind of incentive to make peace. And one can say as much bad things about the Assad government as one likes, but they're not the only ones who are killing. It's a war now, so both sides are killing. So again, you need to say either the objective is regime change, and then I suppose that the U.S. and its allies should say so and say this is not really about humanitarianism. It's never been about humanitarianism. It's about changing the regime in Syria to a democratic regime, maybe, but who knows? Because we've said that in Libya as well. Is what's come after Gaddafi a democratic regime? I wouldn't say so.
Well, you know, let me just throw this out, then we'll go back to the phones here. Another caller. I mean, that the if you look at what's going on now in Syria, Robert Fiskros wrote this other piece in The Guardian where he was saying this Assad's hand will be strengthened. Actually, Mariam Shaheen, our friend, the Palestinian journalist, sent it to us. That it strengthens Assad's hand as the generals are strengthened in Egypt, because as the Arab awakening is crushed in Cairo, it gives him greater strength to do what he needs to do in Syria without fear of retribution. That's part of the struggle we're seeing right now, I think. Why Assad has no reason to say to acquiesce to anybody.
Well, Assad does have a reason because I mean he's I think so because there is a serious threat of intervention. Obviously, Assad has seen what's happened in Libya, and that was 7 months of NATO bombing and the eventual lynching of the previous head of state, namely Muammar al-Gaddafi. That strikes me as a pretty strong intervention to want to sit down and make peace and come to terms with the Western powers.
John, I'm sorry, we're just about out of time. This has been a fascinating conversation we'll come back to and as we watch this unfold in the next few weeks, maybe later in the week and early next week. John Rosenthal joins us. He writes the National Review about Syria. We're here with Adil Shamu, who's Institute for Policy Studies Associate Fellow in Foreign Policy and Focus Senior Analyst. And Anthony and I are also joined by Suni Khalid, who is former Managing News Director at YPR, also former NPR foreign and war correspondent stationed in Cairo, as well as Somalia, Mozambique, Haiti, and more places than he likes to think about sometimes. So it's good to have you all with us, Anthony and I. We'll be back.
Fascinating.
In just a minute.
Thank you.